Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. It's our monthly book show, and the theme is space. With us this morning, reference librarian Jill Erickson. Hi, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
New York Times bestselling author Peter Abrahams. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Mindy. Hi, Jill.
All right. So, space is so big, and so is this topic. And I'm so curious to see what books you've brought today because, wow, there's a lot to choose from.
Space is big, and it's also expanding.
Yes.
And that's part of the challenge.
And it's also, when we were first was suggested that we would do this, Amy Vince, had, our producer, had said, have you ever done one about space, stars, and astronomy? So we have a little bit of space, stars, and astronomy, which all sort of weave together, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it's a big, big topic, like way bigger than I imagined.
Yeah,
it would
be. You got a pile here, and you said you got a just as big of a pile at home.
That is correct. It is tremendous number of books that have been written about space, stars, and astronomy, as well as some really great fiction and really great fiction from the 19th century as well, because Ooh. People were already thinking
what's
about
there?
What's there, what's
yeah,
there,
what's
and
there?
What were they seeing in the sky, and that's a huge part of. All of this is what is anybody, wherever they are, what do they see when they're looking up at night?
Right, and who figured it out? I mean, it's very, you know, billions of people have stared. There's probably 10 who figured out the whole thing.
You think that many? I don't know.
I don't know, because you can name some of them, right? Yeah. But the other thing I completely ignored, but I was remembering it on the way here, there's the whole world of music and the stars.
Right.
Moonlight in Vermont, stars fell on Alabama, but there I couldn't find any book on, you know, the stars and music.
Interesting.
Someone should write it.
There you go. Someone should. All right, let's get started with the books. Jill, what's your first book?
Okay, well, my first book is actually not a book. It's an illustration which should have been in a book. And the illustration, one of the things that I first thought about when we were going to do this was this painting that I had in my house, a small painting, and it was put together by Sophie Blackall, I think her name is here, Sophie Blackall. In 2013, I found this, and I happened to be standing in Grand Central Station. And in Grand Central, if you've been in Grand Central Station and looked up, you'll see, which is not everybody does because they're trying to get to their train. It is a spectacular ceiling, and this is an image of the stars, and it is, and when I wrote to her and asked her if this had ever been published in a book, I wrote to the author to see, that's the wonderful thing about the internet, she wrote back, "Dear Jill, I was for an event exhibition at Grand Central for some anniversary I seem to recall, but it was a missed connection. I don't think it appeared in the book, though. I think I did it especially for the event." And then she writes, "I'm afraid Missed Connections is out of print anyway. I think I should try to find a new publisher for it, though. It was a treasure." And that book, Missed Connection, in fact, I saw a copy of it online. It did, in fact, does not have this image in it. So maybe we'll put this on to the blog when this gets up. It's, as I say, it's beautiful. And there is a book connected to this, which is Grand Central, How a Train Station Transformed America by Sam Roberts. And this has a whole section about looking up. And I was surprised because I did not know that apparently it was done backwards, that the stories were done backwards. And so this is part from this book called Grand Central, How a Train Station Transformed America. Okay, so what's the big mistake in the concourse? Put it this way, Cassius wasn't talking about Grand Central's cerulean ceiling when he said, quote, "The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves," end quote. Once the proposed office tower was scrubbed, architects considered enclosing the concourse with a skylight, but settled on an artificial sky instead. On March 22nd, 1913, a little more than a month after the terminal opened, an amateur astronomer commuting from New Rochelle alerted railroad officials that the constellations were backward. That would not present a problem for linear locomotive engineers, but any mariner navigating by Grand Central stars would wind up like Wrong way, Corrigan. So much for the artist Paul César Helou's gleeful comment to the critic Frederick Mordaunt Hall at the Ritz Barbershop the morning after the ceiling was completed. I have been nearly bowled over with worries, but now all is well, for the stars shine in the firmament. So it's lovely. I mean, should you ever get the chance to go to Grand Central, do look up. It's really beautiful. And I'm sorry this one image did not get into a whole book.
I know why you love that image so much, because everybody in it is carrying a book.
Well, funny you should notice that.
The librarian
it's
in her.
Absolutely, you're absolutely correct on that. Every single person, except for, I will say, right in the center of the image, you see two people kissing, their books are on the floor.
But no one's looking at their phone.
No one.
Yes.
Which is nice.
Yeah. Isn't it? Yeah. It really. Yeah. That, you make a good point, and yes. I won't go into that for long. But just to say, on the subway, I used to run the subway all the time in Boston, and I could see what everybody was reading because everybody had a book.
Not anymore.
Anyway.
Okay. All right, what's your book, Peter?
Well, I have a friend, I don't know if you're listening, Ari, who's an amateur astronomer. He probably isn't listening because I forgot to tell him it's today. But so he's an amateur or backyard astronomer. Okay, that's a whole thing. Like people who have equipment, study the sky, know the sky. And I said to him, what's the best book for you guys? And he said, there's only one that towers above the other. It's The Backyard Astronomer's Guide, fourth edition. That's very important that it's the fourth edition, because the equipment and everything change. The stars aren't changing. Well, they are too, but the equipment really changes. Yeah. It's by Terence Dickinson and Alan Dyer. I love their take on this. So in their intro, they say, with this edition, we have taken the opportunity to restructure the content to reflect the steps we suggest people take when entering the hobby. Start by learning the naked eye sky. Then use binoculars. Gain a familiarity with the sky first and look through a variety of telescopes at star parties. You'll then be better prepared to buy your own telescope. Just as we leave astrophotography to the last, so should you. Don't start your hobby there. Now, my friend Ari takes these deep space photos. I mean, he sends them to me, and they are awesome. That's a very overused word. It's been kind of ruined. But this book is, all the photos were taken by the authors, and they really are awesome. So this is a complete guide to how to become a backyard astronomer, how to learn the night sky, which is the most important part, first with the naked eye. And then they guide you through all the equipment you'll need, and they really tell you which ones. They're not shy about saying, you know, this companies aren't as good as this, which is really interesting. You don't see that every day. But also, there are a lot of fun facts in here. Besides just the beauty of it and getting lost. This is a book you can get lost in. You wouldn't want to read it from cover to cover in one go. But okay, and then there are these little interesting factoids. For example, page 293, I'll just get to it in a second.
It's like a coffee table book with all the photos.
Yeah, it is,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is apparently in the 19th century, there was an amateur astronomer named Eagle Eye Dawes. He was British and dedicated to looking at the night sky. So they called him Eagle Eye Dawes because he found so many stars and stuff like that. And yet, for all his eagle-eyed ability at the telescope, Dawes was so nearsighted that legend has it that he could pass his wife on the street and not recognize her. So that's The Backyard Astronomer's Guide.
I love it. All right, Jill.
Well, I felt it was essential that I bring at least one book about Mariah Mitchell.
Yes.
Because she's, you know, just a stone's throw away from us, more or less, or was on Nantucket. Yep. And the book I have is Mariah Mitchell and the Sexing of Science, an Astronomer Among the American Romantics by Renee Berglund. And this is really a lovely biography of her, but it's also sort of interesting, just the little bits that they come up with within this. So here, for example, they talk about her house. The narrow roof walk stopped Atop the Mitchell's house was just a few boards wide. The house was small and old, and the roof pitched steeply down and away from the little platform. Maria loved to climb from the garret up through the trapdoor and onto the little walkway by the chimney. The roof seemed incredibly high for such a small house. Up there, with just one railing at the level of her knees, young Maria felt she had climbed into the sky itself. When it was windy, the small trees of the neighborhood tossed below her, and the waves slapped and crashed in the distance, punctured by buoy bells and raucous seagulls. When the weather was calm, Maria felt as if she was floating high above the island and the sea in the infinities of space.
I have to correct you, Mariah.
Mariah, I'm so sorry. I do know that, but I appreciate the correction.
I could
because
just
we would have been in
big trouble,
Mariah. My apologies. And I actually knew that it was Mariah. So, of course, she also, what I did not know until looking at this book, I should have, but I didn't. She had the job of supervising the Athenaeum's library. So that on Nantucket. Mm-hmm. And the question was, why was it offered to an 18-year-old schoolmistress with only 1 year of teaching under her belt? The founders might have decided to hire a woman because their budget was limited or because there was a shortage of male workers on the island due to the whaling trade. However, they probably chose Mitchell specifically because she was radiantly intelligent, ferociously witty, and demonstrably knowledgeable about reading, spelling, geography, grammar, history, natural philosophy, arithmetic, geometry and algebra, not to mention literature and astronomy. Mm-hmm. So this is a really great bio, and it has, you learn so much about her and her family and the island and what everybody was looking up. And her father, too, was an astronomer, which is what right. started her off on all of this. So give it a try. Mariah Mitchell and the Sexing of Science, an astronomer among the American Romantics.
Love it. All right, Peter.
Here's a book I can't recommend highly enough. I just loved it. It's called Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void by Mary Roach. So this is, you know, this is all about how the astronauts are trained, how life in zero gravity is so much different from life, and also being crammed into a small space. And she's just a wonderful writer. She's laugh out loud funny in places, such as there's a whole chapter on, I don't know, what should we call it, zero gravity elimination. that had me on the floor. There are all these problems that you wouldn't even think of. And for one thing, this is really an area where no one could ever say women shouldn't be doing this, because women are smaller. They use up less oxygen. They eat less food. They're prime for being astronauts. And of course, now half of them, of ours in this country anyway, are, which is a really good thing. Anyway, one of the great things about Mary Roach, besides what a fabulous writer she is that she tries all these things. She bugs and bugs these NASA people until they let her try the test. So here she is in the motion sickness inducer, because motion sickness goes hand in hand with zero gravity.
Yeah.
The motion sickness inducer of choice these days is the rotating chair. Here the rider sits upright upon the seat, as if preparing to take dictation. A small motor causes the chair to spin on its base, conferring at first glance a joyful air to the proceedings, as the subject had set herself a whirl, the tipsy stenographer at the office Christmas party. At the experimenter's command, the subjects, eyes closed, tilt their heads left and then right while spinning. I took a brief turn in the rotating chair that resides in the lab of space motion sickness researcher Pat Cownings at NASA Ames. At the first head tilt, something lurched inside. "I can make a rock sick," said Cownings, and I believe her. So the book is filled with things like that. Then she... there's a place where they have these volunteers who have to lie down absolutely flat for 2 weeks. And
what?
So the kind of volunteers they get for this are a bit sketchy. For example, Leon M. doesn't appear to have the right stuff. He has a messy past and lingering debts. His most recent job was as a security guard. These days, Leon spends entire weeks in bed, watching movies and playing video games. Beneath the sweatpants and tattoos, however, there's an astronaut of sorts. Leon's skeleton has been diminishing at about the same rate as an astronaut's in space. So these things are wonderful. And then at the very end, she confronts one of the big issues, you know, that lies behind all of our space exploration. Couldn't robots do this better and safer? And I went into this book thinking yes, and I changed my mind. And here she is at the end. The nobility of the human spirit grows harder for me to believe in. War, zealotry, greed, malls, narcissism. I see a backhanded nobility in excessive, impractical outlays of cash, prompted by nothing loftier than a species joining hands and saying, I bet we can do this. Yes, the money could be better spent on Earth, but would it? Since when has money saved by government redlining been spent on education and cancer research? It is always squandered. Let's squander some on Mars. Let's go out and play. Ooh. Anyway, Mary Roach, Packing for Mars.
Love it. All right. If you have a thought for our book list this morning with the theme of space, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. You could also shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly book show, and the theme is space. With us today is reference librarian Jill Erickson and New York Times bestselling author Peter Abrahams. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to suggest a book for us, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill.
Well, we're going into the past now. The far past, well, pretty far past, with a book, two books, actually, From the Earth to the Moon and A Trip Around It by Jules Verne. And it turns out there are quite a few people that were fiction writers who were thinking about what exactly was happening up above us. And the blurb on this book, it says, 93 years ago, Jules Verne's fertile imagination sent an animal to the moon. As a matter of fact, he sent three men and two dogs. He had anticipated space travel and the use of dogs for testing purposes almost a century before Russia made the first attempt. And one of the things that it starts with, which sort of put me off from the get-go of this novel, but is so interesting because it's so dated. The first chapter is chapter one, The Gun Club. And what it's saying about the guns just really resonates at the moment, and for years now. But what he wrote was, during the War of the Rebellion, a new and influential club was established in the city of Baltimore in the state of Maryland. It is well known with what energy the taste for military matters became developed among that nation of shipowners, shopkeepers, and mechanics. Simple tradesmen jumped their counters to become extemporized captains, colonels, and generals without having ever passed the school of instruction at West Point. Nevertheless, they quickly rivaled their compeers of the old continent and, like them, carried off victories by dint of lavish expenditure in ammunition, money, and men. But the point in which the Americans singularly distanced the Europeans was in the science of gunnery. And this whole first chapter is about what good gun players they are, and which is sort of interesting. But what also happens is that they actually are going, the plan is to go to the moon. And it's described, the book itself has been described as Jules Verne had predicted an audience of 5 million, but eerily he got an assortment of other things right. And keeping in mind, this is 1865 when he's writing this. Florida would be the point of departure. A three-man crew would travel to the moon and splash down in the ocean upon return, and the cannon that launched them would be called the Columbiad. The men of Apollo 11 finally went to the moon in a command modular named Columbia.
That's wild.
Isn't it? It's quite something. And then you'll find all these other authors who also are talking about space travel. And one of them is Harry Angstrom's from the Rabbit series, John Updike's once per decade, every man has always, like his creator, had an appreciation of gadgetry. Quote, God, what a lot of ingenious crap there is in the world, he thinks in Rabbit Redux, while shopping in a drugstore on Sunday afternoon, July 20th, 1969, just before the descent in the Eagle to Tranquility Base, emerging back into the Sunday-stilled downtown of Brewer, Pennsylvania, he wonders, where is everybody? Is there life on Earth? This is 1969, the age of migration to suburb and mall. Mr. Updike uses Apollo 11 as part of the thick historical weave, marking the whole Rabbit trilogy. And reactions to the landing are used to characterize the various angstroms.
Wow. So, yeah. I always think that, too, like with a lot of the science fiction, you go, what? It's reality now, right? I mean, but when we were kids, like, this was... didn't exist. How did these authors think this up, right?
That's really interesting how, yeah, that you can imagine something that then can become real science. Well, for example, that shooting through a kind of cannon.
Yeah.
Like there's some people who believe that would be a good way of doing it, just to build an enormous, that will launch people.
Yeah. Crazy.
So, yeah.
The book is...
From the Earth to the Moon and A Trip Around It, both by Jules Verne.
All right. Peter, what's next?
Well, I just mentioned The Right Stuff, Tom Wolfe's famous book on the Mercury 7 astronauts, which I do recommend, but I didn't bring it here.
It's okay.
But the book I brought is kind of the antithesis of it. It is called The Wrong Stuff, How the Soviet Space Program Crashed and Burned. So, you know, when there was a space race that started back in the late 50s, there was a militaristic part to it, but basically it was between us and the Soviets. And it began actually at the end of World War II, where the Germans had all these scientists who built the V-2 rocket, and that was the best rocket in the world. And at the end of the war, we wanted those scientists, and so did the Russians. And we got the best ones, including Wernher von Braun, and he went to Huntsville, Alabama, and that was the beginning of our space program, despite the fact that he had been a member of the Nazi Party and employed slave labor. But so for a while, Huntsville was called Hunsville. There were so many. Anyway, forget all that. We think of our astronauts maybe in the Mercury 7 days, those guys as being kind of space cowboys. But it turns out that the American space program is very, very cautious and careful compared to the Russian one, which was just wild, which really consisted of launching things, seeing what went wrong, and then trying to fix them instead of, you know, all the prep at the beginning. So this is the story of, we mentioned Apollo 11. Okay, there was Soyuz 11. Soyuz is the spaceship, Soylent is the space station, and they had a lot of problems docking it. So Soyuz 11 it turned out to be a very difficult flight where the crew began to really rebel. So I'll just read a little bit of this. To make matters worse, there was a three-man crew. To make matters worse, the crew refused to carry out the exercise routines they were ordered to do as a way of mitigating the effects of prolonged weightlessness on their muscle and bones. They said that when they used the treadmill in the living working area, it shook the station so badly they were afraid the wings of solar panels that powered everything might fall off. They started to feel weak and slept poorly. Then things got worse than that. Sounding highly agitated, they called Mission Control to report that they smelled smoke. Ground Control told them to evacuate to the Soyuz while the situation was assessed. After a while, it was deemed safe for them to return to Salyut, but now they were permanently rattled. They argued constantly. Volkov was downright mutinous. Mission Control, to everyone's relief, ordered them to come home early. They buttoned up Salyut and climbed into the Soyuz wearing only their leisure suits, which became a problem when they prepared to disengage and a warning light began to blink. Sounding nearly hysterical at this point, Volkov shouted at Ground Control, "The hatch isn't pressurized. What should we do? What should we do?" Obviously, they couldn't disengage if the hatch wasn't completely sealed unless they were in their spacesuits and helmets. They tried various procedures suggested by the techies on the ground. Nothing worked. Ground Control finally advised them to tape a piece of paper over the warning light and proceed. Read that goodness. Sentence again. Nothing shouts Soviet space program like that single wow. sentence. All right, I won't read what happened on landing because it was
bad.
It was really bad. But it's this book is unintentionally, both unintentionally and intentionally funny, and also gets behind the scenes because a lot of the truth of what was happening didn't come out till after the fall of communism.
Yeah.
And now I'm not sure we'd get to know any of this anyway. So it was a real window that this author, John Strasbaugh, took advantage of, the wrong stuff.
All right. Carol in Falmouth says, two excellent beginner books about matters celestial are by H.A. Rey, the creator of Curious George. The books are The Stars and The Constellations. Carol, thanks for that. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you have a suggestion, or you can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill.
Well, I found a novel that I had somehow missed. This is one of the terrible things of not going to the library every day, is you miss things. And this actually turned out to be a big hit. It's called Orbital, a novel by Samantha Harvey. And she wrote this. It's a novel set aboard the International Space Station. She wrote 5,000 words and suddenly lost her nerve. Quote, I thought, well, I've never been to space. I could never go to space. Harvey recalled in a recent BBC radio interview, who am I to do this? She only returned to the novel during the pandemic after realizing she should stop worrying about, quote, trespassing in space, she said. Years later, that decision has paid off. Orbital won the Booker Prize, the prestigious literary award. And the book was described as a beautiful, miraculous novel. And it is really fascinating. And one of the great things about this is just these lists that she makes in here. And the basic subject is the International Space Station is a study in contrast with highly technical equipment sharing space with the soft trappings of humanity. And you have this group of people that are up in the space and how they get through it. And here's a little bit where it begins. Orbit minus one, rotating about the Earth in their spacecraft, they are so together and so alone that even their thoughts, their internal mythologies at times convene. Sometimes they dream the same dreams of fractals and blue spheres and familiar faces engulfed in dark and of the bright, energetic black of space that slams their senses. Raw space is a panther, feral and primal. They dream it stalking through their quarters. They hang in their sleeping bags, a hand span away beyond a skin of metal. The universe unfolds in simple eternities. Their sleep begins to thin, and some distant earthly morning dawns, and their laptops flash the first silent message of a new day. It is very beautifully written. She has these characters who all have to live together for a certain amount of time. And this is part of what they miss when they first get there or on the plane. A spaceship, I suppose, is what it is, not a plane. At first, on their missions, they each miss their families, sometimes so much that it seems to scrape out their insides. Now, out of necessity, they've come to see that their family is this one here, these others who know the things they know and see the things they see, with whom they need no words of explanation. When they get back, how will they even begin to say what happened to them, who and what they were? They want no view except this view from the window of the solar arrays as they taper into emptiness. No rivets in the entirety of the world will do except these rivets around the window frames. They want padded gangways for the rest of their lives, this continuous hum. It's really very beautifully written. And one of the things I really enjoyed about it were these lists that she makes, which are really fascinating. And they go, she thinks about all these things that people are thinking about. And here's, this is a little, this goes on for about three pages, but here's just a little bit of it and how she's thinking of what's happening with these people in the ship. In the closing second of the cosmic year, there's industrialization, fascism, the combustion engine, Augusto Pinochet, Nikola Tesla, Frida Kahlo, Malala Yousafzai, Alexander Hamilton, Viv Richards, Lucky Luciana, Ada Lovelace, crowdfunding the split atom, Pluto, surrealism, plastic, Einstein, Flojo, Sitting Bull, Beatrix Potter, Indira Gandhi, Niels Bohr, Calamity Jane, Bob Dylan. It goes on and on. Antibiotics, Billie Holiday, Golda Meir, thermos mass, the Cuban Missile Crisis. This is all what's sort of going through their brain. And the list goes on and on and on. And it, but it's so fascinating what she chooses to put into the list. It's really fabulous. Fabulous. And the end of it sort of is, except, of course, the universe doesn't end at the stroke of midnight. Time moves on with its usual nihilism, mows us all down, jaw-droppingly insensate to our preference for living, guns us down. In another split second, millennia will pass and the beings on Earth have become exoskeletons, cybernetic, machine, deathless post-beings who've harnessed the energy of some hapless star and are guzzling it dry. It's just beautiful, beautiful writing. And these three characters that are on this ship are really just fascinating. And the way they interact one another's. Again, it is called Orbital by Samantha Harvey.
Hi. Thank you. Peter.
Well, this book is called The Human Cosmos, Civilization and the Stars by Jo Marchant. Summing it up, I would say her thesis would be that the mathematicization, a word
spell
I'm making
that,
up,
yeah.
of the universe has robbed it of its awe. And so what she, so she's looking at not science, she's looking at all these like indigenous people from all over the world going back to the Stone Age, you know, in those caves in France, Lascaux, there, there's stars and stuff in there, how the universe appeared to these people, different peoples, but in, not in our modern scientific way. This is not my thing at all, but I really, really enjoyed this book anyway. And it's full of really interesting things. And I'll just give one example. This is the voyage, the first voyage of Captain James Cook. You know, on his third, he ended up being killed in Hawaii. But on the first voyage, he got to Tahiti. And in Tahiti, he met this sort of priest called Tupaia. And Tupaia got on board the Endeavour, their ship, when they were going to go and explore around some more. So they went to New Zealand, which was far from Tahiti. But on October 9th, the ship reached New Zealand, where on the beach of Poverty Bay, Cook made a different discovery, that Tupaia was able to speak with the island's native chiefs. It's a meeting that has been described as an extraordinary moment in world history. Back home, the British couldn't make themselves understood across the English Channel, yet Tupaia and the Maori shared a common language over half an ocean. And it developed over his career, he found that all across the whole Pacific, the people on these different isolated islands could understand each other, which led to the obvious conclusion that they had managed without any navigation as it was there, and it was fairly sophisticated. They Cook couldn't yet do longitude, but they did everything else. Mm. And like they had sextants, they were very good at knowing where they're going, but Tupaia had a totally different approach. And so Cook kind of debriefed him, and they had of course, this is in the Southern Hemisphere where there's no North Star to make it easy. And they had this whole other idea about the stars they would look at. Plus they could kind of read the ocean. So there was this navigation that had nothing to do with what we think of as navigation among these people who are able to get, that turns out they probably came from places like Timor originally, and over a period of several thousand years got all the way to Easter Island and maybe even to South America. So The Human Cosmos.
Love it.
Very enjoyable book.
All right. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to suggest a book for us this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly book show, and the theme this month is space. With us is reference librarian Jill Erickson and New York Times bestselling author Peter Abrahams. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have a suggestion for our list. That's 866-999-4626, or send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill, what have you got next?
Well, I started looking at the stories of Edgar Allan Poe, because somewhere I had read one that was I knew had something to do with space. And so as I was looking around for that, I found something I didn't know existed, which is the Edgar Allan Poe National Historic Site, which and they actually had a whole section on the scientific stuff that he had, the science fiction sort of stuff that he had written. And they write on their webpage, Edgar Allan Poe, ever attentive to the temper of his times, capitalized on readers' fascination and at times gullibility with grand tales of fantastic balloon voyages and feats of mesmerism, marvelous scientific discoveries and amazing technological inventions sparked the imagination of 19th century writers. A new literary genre arose as writers grappled with the ideas and points of view of a society that was quickly changing. And one of those, well, there are several, but one of them is The Unparalleled Adventures of One Hands, and I'm not sure how to pronounce it, P-F-A-L-L, Pafal, I assume, but I'm not 100% on that.
0%.
0%. In The Unparalleled Adventures of One Hans Pafal, for example, Poe, although you think about fall and balloons coming down, but in any case, Poe tells the story of an impoverished bellows mender who escapes his creditors by building a balloon and flying to the moon. Whereas in Melananta Tonta, Poe satirizes 19th century society from the viewpoint of a balloonist in the year 2848.
Wow.
So they really are fascinating. This is this first one, The Unparalleled Adventures of One Hans Pafal. Here's a little bit about what is happening in that. I contrived, however, to pacify them by promises of payment at all scores in full as soon as I could bring the present business to a termination. To these speeches, they gave, of course, their own interpretation, fancying, no doubt, that at all events I should come into possession of vast quantities of ready money, and provided I paid them all I owed and a trifle more in consideration of their services, I dare say they cared very little what because of either my soul or what became of either my soul or my carcass. This is his big ideas going up in the balloon. And it is, it's just sort of interesting that as to how much happens within this balloon that he's gone up in. And he writes, everything being now, my balloon was soon completed. It would contain more than 40,000 cubic feet of gas, would take me up easily, I calculated with all my implements, and if I managed rightly, with 175 pounds of ballast into the bargain. It had received 3 coats of varnish, and I found the cambric muslin to answer all the purposes of silk itself, being quite as strong and a good deal less expensive. So this is, that's one of the stories. There's also a story which is called Melanta Tonta on board Balloon Skylark, April 1st, 2848. And it begins, now, my dear friend, now for your sins, you are to suffer the infliction of a long gossiping letter. I tell you distinctly that I'm going to punish you for all your impertinences by being as tedious, as discursive, as incoherent, and as unsatisfactory as possible. Besides, here I am cooped up in a dirty balloon with some 100 or 200 of the canal, that's the canal people apparently, all bound on a pleasure excursion. What a funny idea some people have of pleasure, exclamation point, and I've no prospect of touching terra firma for a month at least. Nobody to talk to, nothing to do. When one has nothing to do, then is the time to correspond with one's friends. You perceive then why it is that I write you this letter. It is on account of my ennui and your sins. Get ready your spectacles and make up your mind to be annoyed. I mean to write at you every day during this odious voyage. So it's just fascinating that these are, that the whole, the balloon going up balloon thing is essentially early space. I mean, that's what they're doing. They're getting up as high as they can in these balloons, and things don't always go well.
And the name of the book is?
What's that?
The name of the book?
Well, it's actually The Collected Tales and Poems of Edgar Allan Poe, and there are several of these which are about
space,
going up in balloons.
All right. Peter?
Well, now that we're on fiction, a tennis buddy of mine just happened the other day to say that he was a lover of science fiction. And he said Amazon has a list of the top 100 science fiction novels, and he's on number 70.
Oh, wow.
So knowing I was coming here, wow. I said, what's your favorite one? And he said, it's Dune by Frank Herbert, by far. And I said, why? And he said, it's all about so many important things going on today, like ecology, religion, power, drugs. It's all in here. And the idea of harsh environments kind of forging a kind of super people like that happens on this dry planet in Dune. And I myself am a sucker for the desert. So here's the way it starts. It's, you know, the book is famous and there are so many movies and it's the number one science fiction book of all time. And it's kind of compared to, in influence to The Lord of the Rings in the fantasy world, although maybe not quite there. So if just the beginning of it, he introduces Paul. He starts the book with, you know, the main character, which is a very good way to start a book. But we see him as a young man, and he later becomes this sort of Superman messiah figure. In the week before their departure to Arrakis, when all the final scurrying about had reached a nearly unbearable frenzy, an old crone came to visit the mother of the boy, Paul. It was a warm night at Castle Caladan, and the ancient pile of stone that had served the Atreides family as home for 26 generations bore that cooled sweat feeling it acquired before a change in the weather. The old woman was let in by the side door down the vaulted passage by Paul's room, and she was allowed a moment to peer in at him where he lay in his bed. By the half-light of a suspensor lamp, dimmed and hanging near the door, the awakened boy could see a bulky female shape at his door, standing one step ahead of his mother. The old woman was a witch, shadow, hair like matted spider webs, hooded round darkness of features, eyes like glittering jewels. "Is he not small for his age, Jessica?" the old woman asked. Her voice wheezed and twanged like an untuned balisette. Paul's mother answered in her soft contralto. "The Atreides are well known to start late getting their growth, your reverence." "So I've heard," wheezed the old woman. "Yet he's already 15. "Yes, your reverence." "He's awake and listening to us," said the old woman. "Sly little rascal," she chuckled, "but royalty has need of slyness. And if he's really this Kwisatz Haderach, well," within the shadows of the bed, Paul held his eyes open to mere slits, two bright bird ovals, the eyes of the old woman seemed to expand and glow as they stared into his. "Sleep well, you sly little rascal," said the old woman. "Tomorrow you'll need all your faculties to meet my Gom Jabbar."
Ooh.
Well, we're going to meet that Gom Jabbar and a lot of other very unsettling things in Dune by Frank Herbert.
Oh, very good. All right, Jill.
Well, I have a little book here called Starry Night, Astronomers and Poets Read the Sky by David Levy. As it's described, the beauty of the night sky and the discoveries of astronomers have inspired writers for centuries. Originally published in Canada as More Things in Heaven and Earth, this book by the discoverer of comets, also a popular astronomy writer, surveys depictions of astronomy and celestial phenomena in European and American literature, from Chaucer to the contemporary poet Mary Lowther. Of necessity, the treatment of most authors is brief, although he devotes particular attention to works by Shakespeare, Tennyson, Thoreau, and Hopkins. And yes, our favorite guy, Thoreau, our sort of local Thoreau. There's a whole section there called Thoreau and the Sky. And it starts, quote, "I just looked up at a fine twinkling star," an undated entry from Thoreau's journal from the 1840s says, "and thought that a voyager whom I know now many days sail from this coast might possibly be looking up at the same star with me." Which is just a great, I mean, one does think when you look up, mm-hmm. you know, if you're far away from somebody else, are they seeing the same thing? And here's a little bit more on Walden. "A feel for the sky was an important part of what Thoreau got out of Walden. On one sparkling night, for example, he found he was much closer to the skies than he was to his colleagues. He wrote, both place and time were changed, and I dwelt nearer to those parts of the universe and to those eras of history which had most attracted me, where I lived lived was as far off as many a region viewed nightly by astronomers. We are wont to imagine rare and delectable places in some remote and more celestial corner of the system, behind the constellation of Cassiopeia's chair, far from noise and disturbance. It's Starry Night, astronomers and poets read the sky, and it's got all sorts of people that are part of this, and it's by David H. Levy, a lovely book.
Thank you. Peter?
My next one is The Secret Life of the Universe, An Astrobiologist's Search for the Origins and Frontiers of Life by Natalie Cabral. So as she writes, this is the odyssey that I wish to share with you in the following pages. The discoveries, of course, but also the questions that remain unanswered, including that of our humble beginnings. What is the origin of life? What is life? Are we alone in the universe?
Big questions.
And that is huge. There isn't a bigger one. So, and she, you know, and all kinds of discoveries are being made. Like, for example, Titan, the moon of Saturn, turns out to have, under a frozen ice sheet, an ocean of water and ammonia. Water is under there. So the other thing that's really that I liked, so I really like this book. It takes you through where the science is right now. It's a very recent book. But she also deals with Fermi's paradox. And I've always been very interested in Fermi's paradox. You know, Fermi, Enrico Fermi was the famous Italian physicist. He worked on the bomb project. But he's also famous for saying, where is everybody? And that's the paradox. We live in a galaxy with hundreds of billions of stars. There are hundreds of billions of galaxies. There've got to be planets like ours that would encourage the beginning of life. Where are they? She has a really good discussion of Fermi's paradox.
Ooh, interesting.
In this book.
Yeah.
The Secret Life of the Universe.
I love it. Okay. Jill.
Well, and we couldn't not have a mention of The Little Prince by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, who, of course, has a lot of information on what's above us. That couldn't surprise me much. It reads, I knew very well that except for the huge planets like Earth, Jupiter, Mars, and Venus, which have been given names, there are hundreds of others that are sometimes so small that it's very difficult to see them through a telescope. When an astronomer discovers one of them, he gives it a number instead of a name. For instance, he would call it asteroid 325. I have serious reasons to believe that the planet the Little Prince came from is asteroid B612. This asteroid has been sighted only once by telescope in 1909 by a Turkish astronomer who had then made a formal demonstration of his discovery at an international astronomical congress. And this is just such a classic book now, The Little Prince. The copy I have in my hands is 75th anniversary edition by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. And I first read this book when I was a junior in high school in my French class, and I have loved it ever since. So if you have never had reason to pick up a copy of The Little Prince, it really is just a great story, and it takes part on another planet.
All right, good to know. And we will have a list to all the books we talked about here this morning a little bit later today. It'll be up on our website, capeandislands.org. New York Times bestselling author Peter Abrahams, reference librarian Jill Erickson, thank you for tackling this very large topic.
Thanks for letting us loose.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.